tomorrow. Ambassador College presents Garner Ted Armstrong, bringing you the plain truth about today's world news and the prophecies of the world tomorrow.
And greeting friends around the world, this is Garner Ted Armstrong with the good news of the world tomorrow. And there is going to be some good news for a change in a few years. News of a totally different era, a new and a different world where for once you can depend on what you hear and what you read and what people say. A world of such complete and total differences that it's incredible to describe. And I've been trying in quite a few programs over a period of years to tell you about the way the world is finally going to be. But in order to do this, you have to take a good long look at the way the world has been and the way it is today. And the difficult part is finding out what it has been like and what it is truly like today. And so in the World Tomorrow program, much of the time I deal with present-day world conditions as they relate to past experience and as they chart for us a course for the future. Here we are looking around into the last few years of the fantastic, frightening 60s when all the predictions of the 50s were these were going to be the really tremendous times of burgeoning prosperity, a lot of solutions to a lot of problems, a lot of peace and health and happiness almost everywhere. And instead, it seems like we've been living in a time of wars and problems unlimited, and a time now where they're likely to get a lot worse. And it seems to be so difficult, even for political and military planners, to appraise the situation. Now, for example, when a government leader wants to find out what is really going on over in Vietnam, or what is it really like inside Central America, or Cuba, or somewhere in Southeast Asia, or in Berlin, they send top-level and educated thinkers, maybe government aides and military aides, into the area, and they appraise and assess the situation, and then they come back. And they tell the government leader exactly what they feel. Now, the problem with this is that always, of course, they're only going to get one man's opinion. They're going to get one approach or one point of view. So everybody admits, and especially in top-level government, they admit that even appraising a present-day world situation, a present hotspot, a present problem place on the face of the earth is a frankly difficult problem. It's very, very difficult to take the pulse of the problem in any given area. But one thing is sure, if you were listening to a report on the world situation by a president of the world, if there were such a person, and he were giving you the entire panoramic view of human experience today, and then trying to predict to you, based upon what is happening today, what may well occur tomorrow, his predictions would be pretty gloomy. He wouldn't be able to give you an awful lot of hope. And so we've been told by top-level government leaders we've got to get used to living with the problems and not expect to find a lot of solutions. Well, what about the past? Is it a key to the present and the future? Is there any way to really know what is ahead in the future? I've got an ultimate authority. I've got an absolute source of knowledge and information that tells me I can expect exactly what is going to occur in Central Europe, in Central and South America, among the British and American peoples, internally, inside of countries, even about the weather. And that top-level authority is one that I have carefully proved and established as being absolutely accurate because I've checked all of its references. I've checked into the histories to find out if what it said in the past really did come to pass, did occur exactly on schedule and exactly as this authority says. So I have checked this authority. I haven't just taken it for granted and just taking it casually that, well, I'm just a believer of this, or this is the one I would rather quote as opposed to something else. Now, that authority of which I speak is the Bible. And one-third of the Bible is prophecy. And the Bible talks about the future world. It talks about a world of peace and happiness, a world of plenty and prosperity. It literally does talk about a great society. It talks about peace with justice. It talks about everything that government leaders have talked about for centuries, but have been unable to achieve, unable to bring it. But the question is the Bible an accurate authority? Where do I get off telling you the Bible is right, that the Bible is up to date, and that you ought to have any opinion about the Bible other than some casual idea about it being ancient myth or the theology of a bygone race of people? Who is your ultimate authority for what you believe? What is your guide in life? Now you can take a look at history, and let's just plumb the idea for a little while and find out, because, you know, the average person, in his opinions about races, in his opinions about politics, religion,
economics, business, marriage, any facet of society, he is the sum total of that experience and thought that has gone to shape and make up his life, of other influential personalities around him, of his parents and grandparents and his uncles and his aunts and all of his school chums. And in other words, he is the product of his own society. And the ultimate authority for the really big questions in the life of the average person is simply, what is the way the majority of people around him is living? What is the general manner in which the rest of society around you conducts itself? And this would pretty much shape your thought and course of action, except, of course, for those who decide to become a member of the minority, or those who say that they would like to be thought of because this is their particular image as a nonconformist. And so a lot of other people join them, and pretty soon they become a rather big outfit, and pretty soon they find themselves to be the majority, and so then it shifts the other direction again. This is the way it happens, and if we all wore beards and long hair, well, then somebody'd come along with a real weird idea about wearing short hair, and everybody'd get all excited about it for a while, and the barbers would dance up and down with joy, but everybody else would hate it, and in a few more decades, everybody would have short hair again. So that's the way it goes. And we see that there is a minority group afoot now that believes men ought to have ratty, dirty... No, I guess it's just long, isn't it? I don't know if they wash it or not. I see some of the... I don't know what they are. I was going to say boys. I'm not sure of that. I see people walking up and down the streets in London, and their hair is equal length. And you don't know if it's brother and sister, boy and girlfriend, or a pair of brothers, or what. And it's difficult to see, even from the front view sometimes, because I understand some few of them are taking to wearing makeup. But remember, girls, the men started that first. Men started high heels first, and men started makeup first before the women did. Isn't that strange? That doesn't make it right, you understand, but that's the way it happens. Well, now, what is the authority for these people? Well, their only authority is because society and the majority seems to be going one way, and they've decided to rebel against society because they don't like society, they don't like people, they don't like institutions, they don't like the world they see around them, so they're going to rebel, and their rebellion symbol is long hair and a big handbag and an effeminate air. But now, who is ultimately your authority for the really big questions in your life? Who are you? What are you? Where are you going? What is ahead for you personally? What is your future going to be? Most people never ask these questions seriously because they're convinced they can't find the answer. So let's take a look at history. You know as well as I do that history is a matter of interpretation. That history is written by different people in different places, quite differently, about the same events. In other words, you know as well as I do that a student who goes to a school, say someplace in Alabama, is going to learn a little bit of a different aspect about the war between the states, called the Civil War commonly, in the United States, than perhaps a student going to school in Connecticut. Now, it may shock you, but a person going to school today in Western Germany is going to learn a far different history of World War II than a person going to school in California. And somebody going to school in Tokyo, Japan, is going to learn a lot of different facts, quote-unquote. Are they facts? Well, you might look at some of them and you begin to wonder. Then a person who would be going to school in Italy would learn about World War II. So historians interpret the facts along political and ethnic and racial lines. Dr. Thomas, who was a famous historian, said that any good historian must be a good party man in accord with society. And a professor at Oxford, whose name is Freeman, said the writing of history is the writing of past politics. What you want people to believe is what you write today. So, you know, what you might not know is that historians do not just try to find out what really did happen and then present it completely objectively without expressing their view or the view of the majority of the society, but rather they try to interpret what happened to either justify or excuse it, or use it as an accusation against another race, and then they get it all colorful and everything else and put it in a nice book, and then a lot of people begin to believe it. For example, during World War II, I was about as brainwashed as anybody else. I had luncheon with a Japanese gentleman who is in business and a professional man, and we were discussing a little bit about this thing of brainwashing of peoples, and he had spent the war, incidentally, in one of these camps where suddenly the people on the west coast of the United States got frightened about Japanese people, and everybody was rushed away into an internment camp for the rest of the war, and a lot of them lost businesses and properties and personal goods, and he was no exception. And during World War II, I was told there wasn't a word for love in the Japanese language. I forget who said it. Might have been a neighborhood kid. But I believed it. Sure, I believed it. As a matter of fact, I remember right where I was standing when I heard about bombs falling on Pearl Harbor. And I ran over to a house a couple of doors away where an old fella lived with his son who lived with his son. There were three men, grandfather, father, and son. And all the kids in the neighborhood called him Grandpa, and he was sort of a country corncob pipe philosopher. So he told me that, never fear, Sonny, he said, we're going to send the U.S. Navy over there, and they're going to ring that island of Japan with steel, and they're going to starve those little Japanese out in about 6 weeks. He said, I expect the war will take about 6 weeks. I believed it. Now, did you ever find yourself in that position where you believed a lot of garbage that somebody spoke just off the top of his head and really didn't know what he was talking about? It might have been absolute foolishness. Weird ideas sometimes, complete opposite from the truth. There are several words for love in the Japanese language, just like the English language. The love of a mother for a daughter, and the love of wife and husband, the love toward God, the love toward a pet, casual love, deep love, fervent love, you name it. They've got the whole expression just like we have. But of course, the average American person didn't believe this because he began to read history a little differently. I was absolutely shocked recently when I saw that history is being rewritten in Germany, just to show you about some current history before I tell you about some ancient history and what's happened in the past. Just to ask again, who is it who operates the key to the door of your mind? Who is it that controls what gets into that innermost recess of your mind that should be marked top secret? This is the belief compartment. The one thing is what I think, another thing is what I feel, something is what I say and do, but what I believe, that part of my mind is carefully guarded, and I really am careful what I let into that part of my head. Well, it's too bad all people aren't real careful. The German historians today are reaching some fantastic conclusions. And there has been a study of some recently published West German books in the field of political literature, which have given a rather disturbing picture to what might be going on inside Germany today, a new rising nationalism. And first prize for the effort to stir up the waters has got to go to a man named Caspar von Schrenck-Notzig, who has written a book called Character Washing. It's an analogy, of course, to brainwashing, and the content is the criticism of the American occupation in Germany. And he refers to cruelties, it's a 294-page book, he refers to cruelties in it, in 294 pages, once. Now, this is a work of history. This is a work that is talking about modern-day Germany in the light of recent events that have shaped it and made it what it is. It talks about the Marshall Plan, the Morgenthau Plan, and all of this. It's flogged time after time after time. And there's not very much word in there about what it did for West Germany. And if there ever was a Third Reich, you won't read about it in this book. You would never suspect it. Because it just passed over and ignored entirely. Now, from the account, you would think that everything in the Third Reich, if there was a Third Reich, which he hits all around but never comes out and says, was near perfect. The offices could not have been staffed, according to him, with more desirable persons. The leaders of industry were models of uprightness. Neither the school curricula nor the educational methods could have been better. How about that? Then there was another book that's called Deutschland Schuld an Frieden, which is Germany's guilt for the peace. And the author, whose name is Barnick, says that the guilt of the Germans is that they failed to do what they would have been able to do. They failed to wage wars that they would have won. The Germans, he writes, are guilty before history because they were too peaceful, too guileless, too decent. For that, they are still being punished today. Now, in contrast to the other book I mentioned, this Mr. Barnick admits that crimes were committed in the Third Reich on mental patients, a few Jews, and some other undesirable groups. And as could be expected, he brands the reports on the extent of the crimes as being exaggerated. And he asserts that altogether only 100 persons committed the crimes and knew of them. I have a good friend who was with the Allied occupational forces in Germany, and we have offices in Germany. Now, he was over there at Nuremberg during the trials and stood inside the courtroom. So when the motion picture Judgment at Nuremberg came out, he really knew how accurate it was. And the testimony and the evidence and what was said by the prosecuting attorneys and the defense attorneys and all the rest of it, right down the line, he said it was quite accurate. And the amazing things revealed about the tremendous segment of the populace who absolutely knew what was going on, but were ashamed to admit it and so on. Well, that's all old hash. You might say, why go over that? That's years and years back. Well, the point is this, that history is being rewritten in Germany today. And that there exists today a whole new generation of Germans who aren't even sure Hitler ever put to death a single Jew. And you can meet them on the streets of some of the German cities over there, and they'll argue the point with you. Now, you and I, if you've seen the same pictures and read the same books, and I grew up when I saw the newsreels, I know what I saw, and I've still got the books in my own home. The Scourge of the Swastika is one, for example. Book after book after book. With tons of dead bodies, railroad cars full of dead bodies, huge funeral pyres of dead bodies, giant scooped out open earth sort of mass burial places filled with dead bodies, millions upon millions of them. I've still got the evidence. And having been to Germany a number of times, on the average of once a year, and others right as a solid staff having been there time and again, some of them gone right inside of the very places where the ovens are and seeing the pictures and the various weapons and the methods that were used. Well, you know, it's a little hard to just suddenly turn around and to believe what this man has written in the book, that they're being punished because they were too peaceful, too guileless, and too decent. Now, no German feels like he's being punished today on the main because Germany is in the midst of a tremendous boom. But in Mr. Barnick's eyes, I quote his words, the German Reich was notoriously peace-loving. And German statesmen understood the value of moderation, and neither under the Kaiser nor later under Hitler did Germany wish to annex foreign territory, he said. Now, that's just an example to illustrate what I said, that you ought to know as well as I know that you can't always pick up a history book and trust what you read. You can't always pick up a newspaper and trust what you read. You can't always listen to a voice and trust what you hear. You can't always just decide that because somebody says it, you're going to believe it any more than I should have decided as a boy that there wasn't a word for love in the Japanese language and that the war was going to be over in 6 weeks. So, why don't you come on and admit then that if you're going to trust in society as a whole, and if you are going to be a person who merely believes what he sees in print, you're going to end up a very confused person indeed. Now today, who do you believe? Who is your authority? Do you really know the truth about World War II? Do you know the real truth about races? Do you know the real truth about the history of man, about the prehistory of man? Historians don't. How can you? Unless you've got some source, some basis, some ultimate source that you've proved is absolutely true and you can depend upon it, or you can't depend upon men. Josephus, the famous Jewish historian, used to complain bitterly in his works and books that he said when it comes to telling history about the Jews, the Greek historians were the biggest liars in all of history. He said not only do other nations consider themselves liars, or consider the Greeks liars rather, but the Greeks themselves in writing about each other consider themselves liars. And yet Greek history about the Jewish people still can be found in many library shelves today. Josephus time and time again complained about the inaccuracy of the Greek historians. No Jews were accepted or admitted as being scholarly by the Greeks. There was a general of Alexander's whose name was Cassander. And, of course, along with a lot of wars go historians. For instance, today over in Vietnam, there are any number of news representatives and columnists and people who are working as freelance writers and photographers, and all of the major wire services and big newspapers and so on are represented. And there are busy over there military historians, and they'll write up what is happening. And later on, you'll see it in book form or in article form, and it'll come back to you in the newspapers. Well, old Cassander was no different. The generals in yesteryear used to take their historians along with them. And Cassander happened to get a chance to read a couple of works written up by some Greeks who went along to write about some of the campaigns in Asia. He'd been in a series of intensive battles, and he read about it. It was colorful language. It was a terrific story. It was exciting reading. Talking about the stamp of marching feet and the snorting of horses and the jangle of the bits and traces and all the rest of them has been real exciting, you know. But then he turned to the historians after he'd read the works and he said, by the way, where was I when all of this went on? And it was written about his battles. Now, these are in his own words. If you'd like to read them, well, you're welcome. You can read in Cassandra's work. You'll find exactly what he said. Now, there's the period way, way back before what is called the period of record-keeping, when men really began to write on cuneiform tablets. It is called the period of prehistory. And you know, when you look back and you find out what some of the leading historians say about it, it's rather dumbfounding. For example, if you were to get the most up-to-the-minute and the very best and the most authoritative documentation you could about prehistory, the subject of glaciation, about how man first appeared on the earth and all of this, and remember, this is a vital thing for understanding history. Well, you would find there's a man named Schwarzbach from the University of Cologne who has written a book, and it's one of the most up-to-the-minute books, and it's so good that they translated it from German into English. And this author admits the amazing fact that there are 50 major theories which try to explain the subject of prehistory. Now, that means that if you're a college student and you want to study prehistory, you're sort of like a little kid with a handful of dollars in his hand in the five and dime store. And you can take your pick, because here are all of these many, many glittering shells and beautiful things, and you're not quite sure which you would like to choose. But you know, when it comes to studying history and to finding out about the origin of man and whether or not that has anything to do with the future, and whether or not the Bible is true or the Bible is in error, and whether the Bible is myth or whether it's factual, then it's not quite like a little child with his pocket full of money in a five and dime store. But the amazing fact admitted by this author is that all of the theories, all 50 of them, are very insecurely founded. All are in opposition to each other. One says mountain building caused the ice ages. Others say ice ages are the direct cause of mountain building. Who are you going to believe? They all contradict each other. This is the fact that the average college student doesn't seem to know. I know a group who do. I know a group of college students who are educated to wonder whether the man who wrote the textbook was really sincerely searching for the truth. Now, what do you believe about the textbooks I quoted that have been written in Germany? You, wherever you live, Australia, New Zealand, India, the Philippines, South Africa, Great Britain. I don't care if you live in Germany. What do you think about it? What's your opinion? You think that's true, do you? Were you alive then? I was. I don't think it was true. So I'm not going to believe it. I'll take it with about 6 or 8 grains of salt. I just do not believe that the German regime during the Third Reich under Hitler was too peaceful, too guileless, too decent, and had absolutely no territorial desires. I just am not going to swallow that. Now, you can say, well, yeah, but that's just your opinion. But surely nobody's this dumb. But there are people who have been born recently who haven't had the advantage of living on over through an era from the time of World War II into the space age. They're only 19, 20, college age, and they were born after the war. And until they were 6 or 7, they never read very much history. Until they were 9 or 10, they never studied very much of it. Until they were 12 or 13, they never thought very much about it. And by the time they get to be 18 and they join maybe the other groups of students wildly indignant about almost everything, they begin to form opinions. What forms their opinions? Well, the textbooks they read. Who writes the textbooks? Fellows like the one I just quoted from. It may shock you to find a whole generation of people in Germany who do not believe Hitler ever put to death a single Jew. But that is a fact, and we might as well wake up and realize it, and then ask ourselves, what does this mean to us? Well, let's go on. There's a man named George Adam Smith at Cambridge University who said all the religions of the Babylonian era were the most degrading and the stifling to the growth of civilization and barbaric to culture. They diluted and polluted and besmirched the Babylonian culture. Religion did. Then there's a man at Oxford who has written a book, and his name is Faith, and these are the best examples. These are the greatest authorities. These are the top men in the field. These are the real authorities you would want to quote. Mr. Faith says from Oxford that the Babylonian religion gave the Near East the most advancement in culture. Now, both of these statements, furthermore, are made in the same book. And of all things, the book says they're both right. And that is a real head-scratcher, isn't it? They both contradict each other. They're both in the same book, and the book says they're both right. This is history. I had a history textbook on my lap not so long ago. My son brought home, and the fellow made about 6 contradictory statements in the first few pages, and so after a little bit of time, I had my boy convinced he was reading a book written by a liar. Well, either a liar or somebody who had tunnel vision, and could see something right before his eyes and didn't understand what he saw. But he went back to school a little bit suspicious about that history book. He wasn't quite sure, and I went through a few things with him about newspapers, for example. Newspapers are familiar items around the house. They are to me. I wrap my garbage in them when they're a few days old. I send stacks of them back to some paper collector. And I read them when they're current. Nothing is more stale than yesterday's news. And you know, it's my paper. I don't think about it as being 10 million other people's papers. It's my paper. But carried to its ultimate conclusion, a newspaper, especially in the opinion section, is one man reaching one man or one other person. It's one person talking to one other person. But what you see in print seems to carry weight. And anybody who is in a newspaper or on the staff or anyone who is telling someone else what to think or broadcasting or expressing opinions or teaching in a classroom has a rather frightening and awesome responsibility to stick to the facts and to tell the truth. And I got to thinking, you know, every single time where my name has ever appeared in a newspaper or anything in connection with a program or Ambassador Colleges or some national convention or something that was going on where it was merely a reporting of some occurrence as a newsworthy item, I have never yet read one unless I wrote it myself as a press release where it was factual and statistically correct. I was saying jokingly that even on our Ambassador College campus, it's try as they will, some of our student journalists on little campus paper, they try real hard to get the statistics correct on a basketball game, and the chances are they'll come out a few points off when they've got the statistics right there before them and they have no ulterior motive and it's not yellow journalism and they're not muckraking, they're trying their very level best to tell you the truth. And still miss a couple of points here or there because they're human, so I have learned to take newspapers with a grain of salt. But you know, the average person, his newspaper is about as familiar to him as his coffee cup. And it's sort of part of what he believes. And papers are conservative, or they're radical, or they're this and that. This is a part of their image. So people pick up a paper, and a paper attacks something or somebody, and they say, well, what do you know about that? You know, in the Bible, there are many occasions where people expressed opinions about who and what Christ was, who and what a prophet was, who and what Moses was. What about his calling? What was he after? What was he doing? Who did people say Christ was? And then his disciples said, well, they say this or they say that. And the point is, other people believe them. I'm going to continue in this next time. Just a little refreshing session of thinking. Where did we get what we believe? Where did your ideas come? How did you get your ideas about religion, about what you believe about the Bible? Did you get them from the Bible? A lot of people have a very concrete opinion about the Bible, but they've never read the Bible. The average church-going Christian can't tell you the first four books of the New Testament in order, and yet he's got a real concrete opinion about what he's going to find in there. Does that make sense? You need to write for these booklets on Does God Exist and the proof of the Bible and get the proof and find out whether that source is really accurate, whether you can prove it, whether it's possible. And it's free of charge and no price. And request also the booklet on The World Tomorrow, What Will It Be Like? The World Tomorrow, The Wonderful World Tomorrow, by the title of this program. It shows you exactly what you can expect in the fulfillment of these prophecies in the next few years. It's free of charge and no price if you write to Herbert W. Armstrong, Box 111, Pasadena, California. That's Herbert W. Armstrong, Box 111, Pasadena, California. It's free of charge. There's no price. No one's going to call on you. Tell us the name of your radio station to which you're listening. That's all we ask, and then write to the address which will follow again in just a moment. Until next time, this is Garner Ted Armstrong saying goodbye, friends.
You have heard The World Tomorrow. Send your letters to Herbert W. Armstrong, Post Office Box 111, Pasadena, California.